we're still paying very high prices for food and essential items. When do we get relief from this stuff?
Well, if you're asking when are we going to get outright deflation, it's not going to happen, right? We know that firms are very, very unwilling to actually re reduce prices to end consumers.
Hello and welcome to Wealthion. I'm your host, Andrew Brill. Now that the Fed decision to leave interest rates unchanged and quarter one earnings season is winding down, where do we go from here? We'll answer that coming up right now. The date of our next conference is June 1st. We have some of the most prominent names in economics and equities coming to talk about how we can all keep and grow our own wealth. We hope you'll join us. For details, go to our website, Wealthion.com. I'd like to welcome the Vice President and Senior Economist at Rosenberg Research, Dylan Smith, to Wealthion. Dylan, welcome. How are you doing?
Hi, Andrew. Thanks very much. I'm doing great. It's very good to be here on the Wealthion podcast.
Excellent. Now, I know that last week was a bit of a roller coaster. We kind of took a deep breath and no economic news out this week. Maybe some people that are on the, other exchanges like Chicago, I know spoke a little bit over the weekend, but sort of a deep breath. What is your take on, the economy at the present time?
Well, I think Friday's non-farm payrolls are going to go down as an important kind of probably turning point in how the economic narrative has been playing out. We've been saying for some time that there is a lot of weakness beneath the surface that's not been effectively correctly priced in. We've had a series of surprisingly firm or surprisingly hot data coming out of really two headline numbers, or three if you count the two inflation prints over the last few months. I think that have put a bit of a pin in where we thought the year was going to go. So we've had inflation coming in a little firmer than expected, and we've had non-farm payrolls coming in actually much firmer than expected. Both of those two series we've been saying have not been properly reflecting what we've been seeing in all of the other data points pretty much that describe how the economy is doing. And yet those are the two kind of big kahunas that everyone follows. And so that's been kind of driving some divergences, which have been difficult to interpret for the last little while. That's why I think this non-farm number coming in a bit below expectations has actually been more important than the scale of the miss would actually suggest, right? I think everyone, although expectations were at a certain point, they were priced for another upside surprise. But just to get to kind of why we think it's been so difficult to interpret lately, these headline inflation numbers we've been seeing have been driven by essentially kind of genuinely quite firm labor markets and quite firm demand, but only in three segments, right? We've seen healthcare, we've seen education, and we've seen kind of household services and rents becoming, firmer than expected. That's really all that's been holding up the inflation numbers. Goods inflation has been flat to negative. And similarly on the economic side, or rather on the kind of labor side of the economy, we've been seeing, numbers being driven by elements that are not, typically reflective of a robust economy. A very high level of part-time work and a very high share of that driven by kind of economic need rather than genuine preference. Birth-death model and the NFP driving a huge amount of the upside surprise. And yet we've seen vacancies going up. We're seeing quits rates right down, which tells you that people don't have much confidence in the strength of the labor market, despite what the headline numbers will tell you. And so we've actually been, the numbers have been flying in our face a bit. We've been saying, you've got to dig into these numbers a little bit. The firmness is not really there that you'd be looking for, and the breadth is not there that you'd be looking for. And that's, I think that's slowly coming to bear.
Yeah, we got the numbers. Fewer jobs were created in the last week. And what are we missing? There's something under the surface that the Fed is looking at, because Jerome Powell made a reference to unemployment. Now, I know that this is one of the, with consumer expenditures, they keep an eye, a close eye on unemployment. And he wouldn't have said something or given a hint to that if he didn't see something under the surface.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, maybe he knew a little bit about the payrolls report that was coming. But yeah, just to go into the background there, he was asked in the press conference You know, what would it take to push you guys into a cut? Like, what are the sort of thresholds now? And then you gave the sort of standard, you know, data dependent, blah, blah, blah. But he did actually outline two scenarios that would do it. He said, firstly, which he's been saying consistently for 6+ months, further confidence on inflation. Essentially, we need to see inflation resume its downward trend rather than having flattened out just above 3% annualized. But then he introduced a new one, which was, you know, a significant weakening in the labor market, which we hadn't really heard him flag explicitly as a cutting scenario before. Now, you know, we had been seeing mixed data kind of through the week, kind of around his press conference, but NFP was yet to happen. But I think what he might have been referring to, and this is, you know, caveat emptor, this is sort of speculation, but we did have the week before the census data, which basically does the same thing as the non-farms, but, you know, whereas the non-farm survey is under a million firms, the census data covers basically every firm. It's like 12 million firms. And that's very lagged. That data takes a long time to collect and process. So that only goes back to Q3 of 2023. Now, if you remember Q3, we kind of had we call it the late summer surge, where all the data which had been kind of trending down suddenly picked back up again, including the employment data. That's when rates hit 5% soon after that. But what that data showed in Q3 was the widest ever divergence between non-farm payrolls and the quarterly census data. Now, no one looks at the quarterly census data because usually it's just telling you with a lag what the concurrent employment data is already telling you. And the only discrepancies historically we could really find are around recessions where the kind of depth of the signal is different on the two, but the direction is kind of the same, right? But this is pointing, I think, to some revisions coming down the line when they review the annual NFP data. And I think we're going to see a picture of the labor market, which is a bit different to what the first releases and the headlines have been telling us for a few months.
Yeah, because there's a lot of firms that are saying, oh, we're cutting back. Even with these earnings that have just come out, there's companies saying, oh, we're going to come back a little bit. We're going to lower our workforce. That doesn't seem to be in the numbers just yet. Maybe there will be revisions down the road.
Yeah, there are a lot of professional services firms. And, you know, a lot of those industries that really struggled in COVID to find the employment that they needed to match the sudden shifts and surge in demand, they have been holding on to those employees, partly because, you know, it takes a little while to move people out of those types of roles. It's not as sort of flexible as industries with more temporary contracts, but also because, you know, once burnt, twice shy, they don't want to adjust labor forces too quickly. Everyone's been thinking demand might come back again to justify it. But I think there's a realization setting in that post-COVID shortage in the labor market was, you know, part of this just broad disruption and not a base case. And I think we're starting to see some adjustment happening to that. I mean, there's articles all over the place. If you need anecdotal evidence, the consulting firms have started laying people off. The big accounting firms are adjusting workforce. But, you know, the mother of all anecdotal data sources is the Fed's Beige Book. The latest Beige Book was kind of up and down, full of stories of firms saying they're either holding or reducing kind of their labor on the extensive margin. So, you know, I think that, again, is sort of all working in the same direction.
So Chairman Powell said something, and I want to read it because I want to make sure I get it right. He said, inflation is still too high. Further progress in bringing it down is not assured, and the path forward is not assured. What is your impression of that? It seems like he's, you know, trying to pump the brakes on people, like the stock market going crazy again. And it did bring the market down a little bit.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that comment was in the context of him essentially describing why they don't have the confidence yet to cut, right? And there's a bit of central bankerism in there, which is to say nothing's ever assured, don't hold me to it. But he went on to say a little bit after that, look, one thing that we're really expecting to come through in the next few months, which seems to be a little bit more lag than usual, but is, you know, if you look at measures of real-time rent, so if you want to go and rent a house now or switch apartments, those prices are flat to negative. And yet, because of the survey methodology and the fact that they only roll a fifth of the sample every year, that's still reflecting rents basically from the average 2 years ago when the rental market was very hot. So that's one thing that should be pulling down inflation that he actually explicitly pointed to. Goods prices have gone from a drag to sort of flattening out a bit, which was always going to happen. And it really is those few services categories where we're waiting to see a bit of softening for them to gain confidence.
That 2% number that the Fed is looking for, that last percent, because we're hovering right around 3, is being really, really stubborn. What do you attribute that to?
Well, you know, I mean, taking a step a little further back, I remember the conversation, you know, when we started coming down from the peak, the 9% peak in inflation, everyone was saying, oh, you know what, it's going to be quite easy to get to 5%, but then it's going to be a lot of work. And it's actually proven that it was quite easy to get to 3%, and now maybe it's a little bit of work. I think all we're seeing is, you know, inflation, you have to break down into the kind of all the different component drivers. And when you're doing that, what you're seeing is certain services industries, which actually do tally with the warmer side of the labor market as well, which are always the least cyclical. So the slowest to respond to interest rates, the slowest to respond to the cycle, often actually driven by their own internal forces, especially things like healthcare, things like insurance, which are all kind of, you know, adjusting on 1-2 year lags to actual conditions. That's where all the inflation is. And I think all Powell's saying for that 2% target is, I just want it to be going down again, right? He's said before explicitly, it doesn't actually need to hit 2 for them to cut. They just need to be pretty sure that it's going there. And because of this, the support that inflation is getting, or kind of the heat in these few subsectors, which are really, really increasing fast, that's made it difficult for them to cut into that sort of environment. I mean, just for context, you know, you've seen auto insurance up, it's like 80% year on year, right? I mean, there's a lot of adjustment going to like structural changes in the auto market. Accident rates are way up. Insuring EVs is a very different proposition to insuring internal combustion engines. You know, you can have smaller accidents which result in much larger damage if a battery goes. And so that's nothing to do with interest rate and the Fed. That's, you know, that's an industry adjusting to fundamental changes in their landscape. Similarly, on household insurance, we're seeing a lot of climate change related adjustments. That just needs to move its way through, I think, and we'll see things normalize again. But it's not cyclical. It's not policy related. It's not actually something the Fed should be responding to. And yet they seem to be a little more focused on it than we would have expected.
So we're towards the tail end of earnings season. There's a bunch of companies, the big ones, that have come out with, they have piles of cash, mm-hmm. and they're either giving dividends or they're going to spend on AI. But there's a bunch of companies that are not doing as well. Do you see the economy slowing at all?
Well, I think what you're seeing in this earnings season, you know, somewhat a continuation of the trend around tech and AI, which I think was always going to be the case. We've seen a mix of signaling on that, which I think is starting to reflect the realities of the situation, which is that certain firms are doing extremely well and reporting, you know, actual revenues coming through AI. You know, that's more on the sort of hardware side of the industry with NVIDIA and the likes of those types of companies actually benefiting from it. You've also got places like Meta saying, look, it's going to take longer for this to actually show up in the income statement than you might like, or at least in the top line of the income statement than you might like. But, you know, we're putting a lot of money into it and we're hoping to see a lot out of it. And investors, by and large, liking those types of stories. So we haven't seen the kind of come to Jesus moment yet on where the real winners and losers will be kind of long term. I think that's still a very open question. But what we're seeing from the kind of old economy side of the book is really a fairly traditional trading down consumer. So the signal we're getting there is, you know, places like McDonald's signaling, listen, we're about to enter an actual price war. We're going to adjust menu items. We're seeing people price discriminating, even on our own menu, towards cheaper items. We've got, you know, some of the retailers doing quite well, although the more sort of high-end total consumer-linked retailers like Amazon showing, you know, slightly softer results on the retail side of the business. And then, of course, the Starbucks debacle, which, you know, China aside, is showing a slowdown generally in global demand. I mean, there's all sorts of issues in that business, which, you know, we're not really positioned to comment on. But what you are seeing, I think, is people moving down from the very fancy Starbucks latte down to just a black coffee and get on with their day, right? I think there is some trading down happening. And what that means for the consumer is really, you know, okay, we know where the kind of bottom end of the market is, the people who kind of spend their whole paycheck, the side of the economy that is contributing to the savings rate really collapsing and high credit card spending, like that's all a consistent story. I think the outlook on consumption is really going to depend on, okay, what's the upper echelon of the income spectrum doing this? Because those are the people who have seen enormous gains from their house price and their ability to withdraw equity there. And they're seeing a massive wealth effect from recent stock price moves. And so even though, you know, I think most of the economy is out of the kind of pandemic era excess savings that's been spent down, there's been an additional tailwind for kind of the upper end of the income distribution from all the markets. So interesting to kind of see where, like what we can tell about the consumer for those different forces at play.
So one question I have about that, since the lower end of the income distribution is, I'd say they're readjusting, so to speak, whereas, you know, the higher end of the income distribution doesn't have to worry about that as much. But Dylan, we're still paying very high prices for food and essential items. When do we get relief from this stuff?
Well, if you're asking when are we going to get outright deflation, it's not going to happen, right? We know that firms are very, very unwilling to actually reduce prices to end consumers. What we are seeing is that, you know, relative prices are kind of readjusting. So there's a few moving parts at play. One is we had this massive initial spike in goods prices inflation, right? And that was because of how demand had shifted off services onto goods after COVID. We then saw it kind of bleed into more of the services side of the economy as things readjusted. And that was sort of where the shortages were relative to demand. And we put out a piece a few months ago, which basically showed, you know, these two things have actually equalized back to the pre-COVID norm. So not really a relative prices story, but I think when you hear in the media about, you know, things are expensive, you know, consumers aren't lying. The average sort of grocery bag, you know, has almost doubled from pre-COVID levels. So although inflation is running low right now, I think the sort of challenge that policymakers and economists face is to explain that, you know, this readjustment is not going to happen back down again. This is a fundamental kind of change in sticker prices. And the big question, I think, is how do incomes readjust to that? So we've seen in many sectors, there has been real income catch-up and real income adjustment, but not in all sectors. And I think that's what's part of the story, you know, behind things like how many part-time jobs are currently being taken, people who, you know, can't adjust from one job to the other without driving an Uber in between, you know, just to make ends meet. So I think that's a big part of the story and why demand is a little dampened on that side of the economy is the sort of budget shock is still kind of happening. And this is interestingly happening at the same time that you have still, you know, package holidays demand very high. So there's still an element of, you know, while we're sort of angry about grocery prices, we're still going to go to Disneyland because we couldn't do it 3 years. So there's very interesting kind of cross currents happening there. But I think the broader pattern, which we're seeing back to the earnings release question, is that I think that force is fading and reality is setting in.
And the latest wage report is that wages are up, but they're not up as much as they had been. Like the wage growth is slowing. So if prices don't come down and wage growth is slowing, at some point there's going to be, I wouldn't call it a price war, but perhaps prices could start to come down if people can't afford what staples they need.
Right. So we're seeing inflation. I mean, depending on the measure, there's lots out there, but running somewhere in the order of sort of 4%, and you have inflation running just over 3%. So we're still seeing a little bit of real income catch up happening, but it's at a much slower pace than it has been for a while as wages moderate down. But you're absolutely right on sort of businesses' ability to pass through costs at the moment. We're seeing in the Beige Book and in all sorts of regional Fed data and reports, everything is pointing to margin compression, at least for the sort of small and medium-sized firms in the economy. Larger firms, it kind of depends where they're playing, but firms have lost the pricing power that they've enjoyed for two and a half years. And yes, there are definitely sections of of the economy where that will mean that prices do actively come down. You know, on average, we're not looking for a base case of deflation. But getting to 2% against that background is not going to be that difficult.
So with getting down to the 2%, but we could hurt a little bit and struggle until we get there because prices aren't going to really come down. And unemployment is sort of creeping in the upper direction. So there's going to be people out of work that can't actually pay for what they need. So I would assume, and it, correct me if I'm wrong, at some point, things have to level off.
I think that's right. And I think that's why Powell has explicitly said he doesn't have to see 2% to cut, right? I think, you know, and that's why he flagged the labor market as, you know, one of the potential scenarios that actually could lead them to cut, kind of inflation aside. Yeah, I think that's right.
So talk to me about the bond market a little bit. I know the Fed has been pumping loads of bonds into the market. They've been, I heard, $1 trillion worth of bonds by July. But now they've sort of put the brakes on that a little bit. So we're going to slow that down. How does that affect the economy and the Fed's ability actually to pay its bills?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that was actually the big news out of the Fed meeting, given that Powell managed to avoid banana skins that the press were trying to put in front of him. The big news was QT is slowing down. The way it was presented, which I think is right, is it's essentially a risk management operation, right? We saw during the last balance sheet reduction, in this 2018, that, you know, as the Fed allowed runoff, there were some short-term liquidity issues in the overnight markets as a result. You know, you get quite lumpy cash flows there, and their parents may cause some stress. And there's been some conversation for a while among the FOMC members that, okay, we actually have the luxury of not running off as aggressively as we've started. It's been fine, you know, to sort of allow their runoff to be pretty aggressive and actually sell assets onto the market to hit the $60 billion a month on treasuries. But, you know, now that we've done a big chunk of that and we're sort of heading towards the balance sheet size we want, we can slow that down. How big of an effect does that have on the bond markets? Well, you know, as we've seen before, QT can have very large effects on kind of interest rates and funding markets when it's going a little bit wrong. But all the evidence and all the research on balance sheet reduction actually points to pretty small effects, like in the order of a few basis points already. And nearly all of that happening on announcement because, you know, the schedule is extremely predictable. Markets are, you know, at least in this case, forward-looking. And they can price in the supply they know is coming from the Fed in terms of how much they're putting on the market. So, you know, some small share of the decrease in yields that we saw around that Fed meeting is probably the most of the effect of slowing down QT. But there is a kind of broader picture that this feeds into, which is that, you know, given the amount of issuance that the Treasury's been doing, new borrowing from them to fund not only all the kind of large infrastructure spending programs that are happening, but just, you know, a very high level of general federal outlays, markets have been asked to absorb a lot of Treasury supply, including, you know, in addition to what the Fed's already putting on the market, that's $60 billion a month. And so I think that's what's keeping rates at the longer end of the yield curve a little higher, even though we're seeing expectations of an eventual cutting cycle happening. So, you know, as that cutting cycle happens, I think we're inevitably heading towards somewhat of a steeper yield curve as we bring down the front end. But you have, you know, a highly indebted U.S. government that will need to issue for a long time and no clear avenue toward a stabilization in those finances under either election outcome at the end of this year. And so markets are going to have to keep that in the back of their minds. That could keep short-term rates very low, actually, interestingly, as kind of, you know, other parts of the economy are sort of crowded out. But it means that longer-term rates tend to stay a little higher. So that's actually a kind of force for yield curve normalization. Now, does that mean we think that there isn't great value in the 10-year 20-year end of the curve? Of course not, because you have duration effects there. And we do think that the move through this year has been kind of overdone. The Fed's cutting cycle has certainly been delayed by, you know, the inflation and unemployment stuff we were just talking about, but it hasn't been canceled. And so, you know, you can see a normalization on that side of the yield curve, even with that kind of fiscal backdrop, which on a duration adjusted basis is actually fairly attractive, we think.
So, Dylan, how do we deal with this massive amount of debt we've gotten ourselves into? It was $34 trillion. Now it's $34.5 trillion. It's going to be $35 trillion before the end of the year. I mean, you know, each time we issue bonds, it's more money we're spending. That, along with all the spending that we're doing to keep the country safe and our allies safe and everything else we're spending money on, obviously, stop spending money is one answer, but it's not exactly that easy, is it?
Well, that's exactly as far as this discussion tends to go, right? You can ask any expert, what's the way out of it? And the answer is pretty easy, right? You've got to reduce spending. You've got to try and do it in a way where you can balance it without adding too much to the tax burden, because that, you know, reaches a point where it actually has kind of negative feed throughout the rest of the economy. You've got to keep the spending, the part of spending that's very productive, i.e. sort of investment spending that's going to have returns. And you probably have to spend on the military given the state of the kind of world situation. So then you say, okay, well, so where do you find the cuts? And everyone shakes their heads and goes, tut, tut, it's so terrible. Congress is dysfunctional. We'll never do it. And that's not a great picture for anyone thinking about kind of the long-term evolution of the U.S. economy. We try to put a bit of thought into this. And a few months ago, we published a report. We have the benefit of having quite a close connection to Canada. We're actually Toronto-based in terms of our office, although we have a U.S. and global outlook. But we know that Canada had a similar situation in the 90s, right? There was a 1994 budget, which was the sort of culmination of years and years of fiscal slippage and showed more fiscal slippage, which bond markets actually just completely revolted against. Very similar to what we saw in the U.K., a year and a bit ago under Liz Truss, which ultimately forced her from office. And that hasn't led to much reform on the public finances side in the UK, but it did in Canada. But I think the important thing to emphasize and some of the findings of our research there is that, you know, it wasn't just that there was some trimming around the edges and a few adjustments, right? The social contract was reimagined in Canada. And it took enormous effort to kind of bring that program through and bring it under control. It was helped by the fact that the governor at the time, the Liberal Party, had a very large majority, and so it could force these things through. But we saw large changes to the pension system, large changes to the sort of how the general social security system, healthcare, education, etc., was funded through the provinces. You know, smaller or changing the contribution system that kept the pension schemes going, a broad reduction in program spending where all sacred cows were eliminated. There was a very strict means testing policy or efficiency testing policy around the different programs that were in place. Anything that didn't meet up was not trimmed but wholesale cut. With the promise that certain ones would be brought back later, which they were. And so it was an enormous effort, and it kind of dominated the political program of that party for the entire first term. In other words, they had to let go of other priorities that they actually ran on in the election. And I think the U.S. is in a similar position, right? It is harder to do, given the institutional setup and the level of partisanism in the Congress. But I think to get off the 120% to 123% debt to GDP ratio, which will only increase under current trends, that's the level of effort, that's the level of focus, that's the level of kind of significance, I think, that would be required. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of hope of that under the current setup, but who knows what a new Congress might bring. But it will take a serious refocusing, which is not currently being talked about much.
And probably won't be talked about because this is an election year and people want to know about their pocketbooks when they go to the polls. And it's one thing that I guess they could talk about, because they could talk about bringing that down and putting more money in people's pockets. But look, when you tell people that we need to pay down the debt and we're going to tax you a little bit more, that's not going to be an easy way to win an election, I would assume.
yeah, we're going to change Social Security. No one can say that. so this is off the table until the election for sure. And after that, we'll have to see. Now, based on current record, you know, the Biden administration has been a very free spending administration, partly related to kind of COVID recovery and so on, but also following the kind of COVID spending was a very large infrastructure investment program. You can argue and debate about the long-term kind of ramifications of that, whether it's going to be efficient public spending, whether it will be big economic return. But until, you know, the evidence there shows up, all we know is that that has sustained very high deficit spending. And then the kind of wave after that has been just that current spending has been a lot higher than anyone expected. We saw, you know, if you assume a relatively small multiplier, you still find that last year, direct and indirect effects of public spending accounted for like 2/3 of GDP growth, right? So it's been an enormous additional extra stimulus that almost, you know, everyone was predicting a recession. It was almost like they did a preemptive Keynesian policy, right, by just massively stimulating or keeping stimulus going. So, but the point I'm trying to make here is that, you know, if Biden kind of remains in power and it's a Biden-led administration, well, he doesn't have a track record of fiscal prudence. Now, that's not to say he can't change his mind, but he's certainly not campaigning on changing his mind. And in focus groups and polls, this is, you know, public debt is not coming up as a key issue. There is no part of the electorate or no sizable part of the electorate that, you know, you're going to win over with this. It's not 1991. And meanwhile, you know, we know that Donald Trump kind of appeared to assess his efficacy by the state of the S&P 500. And the easiest way to keep that up is to kind of, you know, just not tax cuts probably. And which we know, you know, large sections of the Republican Congress are quite keen for. But, you know, as we saw last time, probably not too willing to offset that on the spending side. So you actually get additional fiscal stimulus probably in that scenario too. So it's very hard to see a path to a real big reimagining of prudence without something going a bit wrong first and bond markets basically throwing a tantrum and forcing them into it.
In addition to the bond markets, conversely, I guess gold and Bitcoin have been on the rise. And talk to me a little bit about that and how that's affecting everything.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll deal with the Bitcoin piece first. I mean, we're not big believers fundamentally in Bitcoin. We kind of side closer to the Bank of England, who says that its fair value is zero, than the sort of crypto enthusiasts. That said, I mean, I think the recent moves, it's all about ETFs, right? So there's just been enormous inflows. You know, even large institutions and kind of large funds who were not so keen to invest in these crypto exchanges, which we've seen explode time after time, say, okay, I'll stick 1% in and call it diversification. And that's actually led to a pretty massive surge in demand for Bitcoin. So that's what's behind the price moves there. But gold, I think, is a bit more fundamental and very, very interesting. It has not been a traditional gold bull run, right? So usually gold is pretty closely tied to, well, for one thing, supply dynamics, but also on the demand side, it's really about the dollar and real interest rates, right? So if inflation is to go up, if interest rates, nominal rates are to go up, that all affects the gold price a lot. You know, if the value of holding cash is, you hold cash at 5%, why would you hold gold at no yield? Similarly, if inflation goes up, it's a defensive asset against that. Equally, a weak dollar kind of boosts the gold price. So that all is not at play at all at the moment. We've actually seen over the duration of the gold rally, all of those forces moving actually against the gold price. We've seen inflation coming down and then stabilizing over that period. Long-term inflation expectations have actually continued to stabilize. We've seen rate cuts being delayed, so an effective sort of tightening there. We've seen the dollar extremely strong, right? So what's going on with gold? Well, it's everything else, basically. So you do have, you know, the marginal cost of production has been steadily sort of rising. The whole sort of cost curve has been shifting up over the past few years. It's become more and more expensive to find and mine gold. That's been setting a bit of a floor under the price, but you're also seeing enormous demand sources coming out of basically kind of the East, right? So we have central bank buying, which has been a sustained trend, largely related to kind of geopolitics and kind of shifting world order. Different banks have different reasons for doing it, but all of them are seeing reasons to trim down dollar reserves a little bit and hold gold instead. So in central banks around Russia, that's a lot to do with just wanting the security of physical assets locally in case, you know, systems get disrupted. In places like Turkey, it's a lot to do with sort of domestic inflation. And in places who, you know, care about the Chinese-US relationship and what that means for kind of reserve bases, well, the dollar's losing a bit of its power as a global reserve as the global influence and the US's role in globalization kind of diminishes a little bit and this rift emerges with China. But equally, renminbi is not an excellent reserve asset either, and there's some concern as China drifts off on its own that, you know, this kind of two-currency global system people were thinking might start emerging, you know, 10 years ago has been seriously rethought. And so it's just prudent for central bankers to hold a bit more gold. And then kind of the biggest move has been China itself wanting to reduce its dollar reserves and hold gold instead, which is a bit more neutral geopolitically. So, and by the way, China has very small gold reserves as a share of total. It's still under 5%, which by global standards of banks who hold gold, it's, I think the median is like 13%. So that's not going to stop. It takes a long time to adjust central bank reserve holdings. You got to wait for some stuff to run off. You have to wait for gold to transit. You don't want to buy it all at once. So that's going to put a big sort of demand base around gold for some time as those trends play out. You've also had actual retail, I call it retail demand for gold in various places be very strong. So everywhere with high inflation, so we're talking Turkey especially, which has had very high inflation and has a traditionally sort of gold bug kind of attitude, you know, very high retail demand there. We're seeing places like India, which also traditionally very attached to the metal. As India becomes wealthier, you know, a lot of savings get stored in gold, so that's a good tailwind. And we've also seen sort of segments of the Indian population that don't like where the country's going kind of politically have also been demanding a lot of gold and are holding that, selling property in some cases and buying gold. So that's all there. And then Chinese speculation has been another tailwind. So the picture we've kind of painted is that, you know, these are all quite structural forces of physical demand. They're not really going to disappear too soon. And they've been the sort of big impetus behind this large gold rally. What happens when the US does cut rates and inflation gets to 2% and the dollar weakens? Well, you should have even further gold demand. What happens when the conversation we've just had becomes more mainstream? People get worried about US public finances. You should get more gold demand. You know, what happens the next time there's another big geopolitical disruption and, you know, I don't know, North Korea does something strange or Taiwan, right? There's lots of reasons to think the gold price can continue to go up. And so we said, you know, the $3,000 an ounce on the card for sure.
Wow. So aside from gold, I guess that's, you know, in this economy and with our viewers, how do we protect ourselves? Obviously go and buy gold. It's about 2350 an ounce. So you could get a nice return there, I guess, if it does get to 3000, but how do we protect ourselves right now?
Yeah. So gold, if you're buying now, you've missed the first leg of the rally. There's probably, you know, it's gone sideways for a little bit, but encouraging that even kind of with everyone sort of commenting on how strong the move has been, I think the momentum is, as we say, still up. So, you know, holding a slight overweight in gold is probably quite sensible. We still like bonds, and we like them, especially after this non-farm payrolls report, which I think is going to start to shift the narrative. We've been wrong about bonds for some time. The cutting cycle has been much more delayed than we thought, but the fundamentals are kind of all still in place for a readjustment there. It's hard to look at the economy, you know, especially if you get inflation down another half a percentage point and continue sort of slackening in the job market. Very hard to say you need to be, you know, 2+ percentage points over your estimate of neutral. And so if neutral is around, you know, estimates vary wildly, but no estimate is anywhere near 5%, right? You got to get down to 2.5, 2%. And so that's very positive for bonds. And so, you know, I think kind of time to move along the yield curve a little bit, get out of cash a little bit and start to take a good bet there. Equity is a little more challenging, but I think it's going to get a little more sectoral. Anything that is much more cyclically exposed, I think, is going to start losing a bit of ground to the segments of the market, which are just kind of trading this big AI bubble. That can go on for a long time. Something I think will eventually bring it down to earth. We've seen with these types of sort of enthusiastic periods, and obviously the dot-com bubble is the most commonly cited reference point. Early on in a big new technology, it's very hard to tell where the long-term value is going to pool. So at the moment, we're getting everyone buying the chip makers and the data center producers, and that's, I think, all correct, and that demand there is very, very high. But remember what happened to Cisco, right? They massively oversupplied. And it turns out the real winners, Google and Facebook, hadn't even been thought of yet. Right? So hard to say where value will pull. There's a lot of enthusiasm. There's a lot of money going into it. Something will happen to, but we're not going to even try and call a timing on that.
Right. Yeah. Ride the wave and just, get out when you're comfortable. Yes. So Dylan, you have a podcast with kind of recaps the week's events. Tell us about that.
Yeah. I co-host, with my colleague Jacob, a podcast called the Rosenberg Roundup. We do two things on it now. So we do a short, very snappy weekly roundup every Friday. And it's the kind of conversation we've been having now, but in 15 minutes. So we recap the week's events, kind of what it means, how to think through the week that's coming. And we also sort of spotlight some recent research we've been doing that usually is a bit more thematic and a bit less tied to the kind of daily, weekly data flow. We also do occasional guest interviews with interesting people, usually clients of ours or prominent people in the markets. Those drop around once a month. They're more like half an hour in length. And we try to have a slightly more interesting, specialized conversation with those people.
And to get more insight from you, where can we find you on social media?
You can look up Rosenberg Research. And of course, Dave Rosenberg, our founder, has probably the biggest presence. We're on LinkedIn, we're on Twitter, and of course the podcast in your iTunes and Spotify.
Dylan, thanks so much for joining me. This has been educational for sure for me, and I hope it will be as well for our listeners and our viewers.
Well, it's been lots of fun, Andrew. Thanks for having me on.
That's a wrap on another discussion here on Wealthion. Thank you for joining us. If you need help being financially resilient, please head over to Wealthion.com, sign up for a free, no-obligation consultation with one of our registered investment advisors. And remember to follow us on social media for the latest news and information to help you invest wisely. And if you could, like and subscribe to the channel, we would greatly appreciate it. And don't forget to hit the notification bell so you can find out when we post new videos to the channel. Thanks again for watching, and until next time, stay informed, be empowered, and may your investments flourish. Thank you.